Welcome to the Northern Business Podcast, our regular discussion with people in the north of England who lead businesses, employ people, and have new ideas to help our economy grow. Northern Business Podcast is produced by Recognition PR, and we serve companies in different sectors all across the country, some of which occasionally contribute. We're kindly sponsored by Virtue Motors PLC, one of the top automotive retailers in the UK, with a network of dealerships representing some of the world's biggest brands. It also has the successful commercial vehicle retailer Vans Direct. I'm Graham Robb, and today I'm presenting with Joss Haverkin, and having the studio, Alice Woods. Alice is Managing Director of Dream Boys. We'll tell you about that business in a minute. And down the line, we have Rob Shaw, who's founder of MetaTeam. Joss, busy week for you. What have you been up to?
Yeah, it has been. Well, in the last few days, you and I have been off to Tees Valley Business Club, where we recorded a special of this episode. They'll be able to hear, I believe, on the 18th of December. It'll be going out as live on the LinkedIn channels and then on the podcast channels as usual. And it was actually really good. It was a celebration of success in 2024. And I think people here on the show today and who are listening at home or in the car will probably have agreed it's been a roller coaster year.
It certainly has.
But it's good to hear a lot of positivity going into 2025.
I think that's right. And people, I think, in business are gritting their teeth and saying, yeah, let's defy it. Let's defy all this doom and gloom. Rather like, you know, the old TV show, Ain't Half Hot Bum. The Grenadiers in India, the concert party, and they used to look at the sun and say, come on, sun, do your worst. Well, Whatever's happening in the economy, businesses want to defy it and get on with it.
Absolutely. It's a very good chance to be an accountant, let me tell you that.
I visited a business which is based in Yorkshire and makes robots for the pharmaceutical and food sector. And they're very busy, and it all goes down to productivity, which is going to be the theme of our second discussion today.
Excellent. Look forward to it.
Now, I must introduce you to Alice Woods. Alice, thank you for coming into the studio.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I wanted to tell your story because it's a story that is a little unusual in that you have ended up owning a business which is a little avant-garde. But before we go into that, tell us what you started your career doing.
I actually started out as a classical musician. That was what I was trained to do. And I did love entertainment and performing. It was a big part of my life. But I decided my other love was numbers. So I went to LSE. I did a conversion master's to finance and accounting. Worked for Schroders in their global equities department. And I thought, still not quite for me. So I was looking to go back into the entertainment space, and the Dream Boys brand came up for sale. And at that point, it was in a part of its evolution where it was very popular, was selling a lot of tickets, but it needed modernizing. I felt it needed a woman in charge. It had male owners previously, and I raised the funds, bought the brand, and here we are today.
So you've gone from being somebody in the City of London, where you were trading equities, presumably making a lot of money and understanding how deal-making goes on.
Yes.
So you use that money and some of that skills and you buy a troop of male strippers.
Yes. Yes, I did.
Is strippers the right word or is it entertainers?
Yeah. Strippers? Well, we say we're an all-male dance troupe with a twist.
Right.
So, but yeah, I mean, that is how the boys would define themselves. So they've all consented to being defined as strippers. So we have no issues with that.
Now, I think this is a fantastic story. You live in Yorkshire.
I do.
And you have located the Dream Boys in northeast England.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a northern business. But it isn't a new business. It's something that's pre-existing. Around the time of the Chippendales, that were famous American dance troupe, the Dream Boys happened. So what's the history? What's the legacy you've bought?
So it's been around for 35 years now. It was started in the UK by a hairdresser, actually, who he was working with male models. And he thought, maybe if I make them dance, that might be quite popular. So he started out in Soho in the basement of Madame Jojo's, a really iconic club, which is sadly shut down now. And he grew it from a PR perspective. He had people like Princess Diana attending performances, and that was the start of it. But it was still very much London-based. They did tour, and then it was taken over by a performer. He grew it into more locations, focused on more of the hen party side. And then when I took it over, I've taken the touring show all over the UK and international, and expanded all of our nightclubs. So we do about 500 shows a year in nightclubs with regional teams, and that's all over the UK, from Cardiff, Bournemouth, up to Edinburgh, Newcastle, Leeds, Manchester, Liverpool, any key destination in the UK, you will find Dream Boys on a Saturday night. And then we tour around all the theatres and arenas in the UK, and we've just branched out in Europe, and next year we'll be launching in Asia.
Now, it's the first time of doing the Northern Business Podcast now for a couple of years that we've had an impresario. But this is the business of show business.
Yeah.
Because it is actually a business, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. And I'm very much focused on that side. Although I do have creative oversight and I very much enjoy that part of the job, a lot of my time is, you know, Excel spreadsheets and ticketing software and productivity and using AI and how can we serve our customers better and how is their customer journey as quick and easy as possible to get their ticket. So I'm, you know, very much focused on all of that as well as the men.
Well, we hope that the consumer complaints don't happen, but they're only about reviews of the show rather than not being able to get the tickets.
Yes.
In the current business then, when it comes to buying tickets for live events, what's the economy? How is it shaping out? What's the demand like?
Well, so for us, we've done really well this year, and I think it is because we are an affordable luxury. So it is predominantly women who go. So things like getting your nails done, getting your hair done, a ticket to Dream Boys, it's still affordable. So even within this current climate, which is really challenging, you know, our place is still firmly there, especially things like a hen party. People actually don't want to compromise on that. So we've done really well. I think our struggles have been with venues, because overall, venues are finding it hard. There's been a shift in the nighttime economy post-COVID. People are going out less, people are meeting on apps. People don't just go out to socialize anymore, mm-hmm. quite like they used to. So although demand is really high for our tickets, placing our show in venues and having really stable venues has been a challenge.
It's interesting.
I was just going to say, I can understand how you've maintained and maybe grown ticket sales from what you said, because I can see your show, The Dream Boys, being the anchor of a night. You're going out to see the Dream Boys, and then the drinks and the food, etc., are on the periphery of what it is that you're doing.
Yeah, precisely. And that's another challenge, because you have high streets where you might have had a lot of restaurant choices, and we also sell big hen party packages, and we work with all the big chains, Pizza Express, Slogan Letters, all of those, send our groups to them. Same with our after parties. We work with all, you know, local nightclubs or in that particular city. And when you see the closures of these types of places and the erosion of the high street, it does impact us too as well, because they're wanting their big night out. Dream Boys is that central focus. That's the main event. But of course, you want to go for maybe a cocktail making class, and then you want to go out afterwards. So the stability of and long term future of all of those types of venues is really, really important. And I feel that's our biggest challenge right now, which is slightly out of our control.
I suppose when it comes to live events, live music and live performances, you've got different levels. And if you look at sort of the Taylor Swift economy, that's right up there. It has a huge ripple effect on the economy.
Yeah.
And then maybe at your level, it's, as you say, a less costly night out, like a trip to the cinema.
Yeah.
But in the middle, maybe that's where the economy might be being hurt for those performances, not ones you do.
Yes, yeah, that's true. And speaking of Taylor Swift, so she has her Swifties, but we have our Dreamers, a very dedicated, loyal bunch of fans who they will go to 20, 30 shows a year, traveling all over the country, following the boys, interested in, you know, when we have a new dancer join. And those people and growing that fan base and building that community is something we're really focused on as well, because that ensures that long-term future.
I have to ask about one little parallel with Taylor Swift. Obviously, you see, I didn't go to any of Tay Tay's concerts, but I did see a lot of videos of people getting up and doing the dance routines. Do you find a lot of hen parties getting into the middle aisle and joining in?
Oh, absolutely. We can't get them to sit down. They're trying to go onto stage, and I think that's the security also a big challenge, trying to calm people down, because it's meant to be a seated show. But we've had people storm the stage before, and the meet and greet, which is after the show, very popular.
Now, right. I wanted to just stress to anyone listening or viewing today, the show, I haven't been to see it, but I did ask one of my female members of staff if they'd like to go, and they did go. And the reviews were, okay, there was no problem. But the most important thing, it isn't pornographic. It still falls into a sort of lighter entertainment. Adult, yes, but
yes.
It's not the kind of things you're going to see in the red light district of Amsterdam.
No, it's a naughty night out where you can scream, you can shout, you can be yourself, you can let yourselves go. You're in a very safe space. So the way I often describe it is it's the same as when men go to a football match or anyone goes to a football match. It's somewhere where you can just really let your hair down, have a good night out. And there's a bit of titillation and naked men to feast your eyes.
I don't think we'll have to put an 18 plus rating on this episode.
No, this episode. No, we're not flashing up stills. Well, look, thank you for joining us. Come chip into the next bit of the conversation, because I think in your previous career, you've got probably a lot that you can add to. But let's turn our attention to Rob Shaw, who's founder of MetaTeam. Rob, you're working with a lot of businesses in the Northeast. Tell us what you do, and the north of England, Manchester, Leeds. Tell us what you do.
Yeah, hi. Lovely to see you. So we are all about team-based learning and growth. But interesting, a lot of commonalities. It's about customer journeys. It's about the impact of the events we deliver. And we work with teams to help them accelerate improvements in productivity, sort of engagement, performance. And we do that through a number of different factors that we think are really important about how you really get teams to engage, to look inside themselves and get on that improvement journey.
Now, post-COVID, business has been in a recovery phase, and it probably has recovered from COVID to a large extent now and found its new level.
Yeah.
But this year, they've been the new challenges of the budget, and I've talked to countless businesses who are regarding the budget as a spur to productivity, something that in some cases has caused businesses to do what probably they should have done anyway.
Yeah, I think absolutely. We see team leaders especially are feeling really burnt out. So there is the expectations and the need of driving improvements in productivity. But there's a sense of, we find that sense of people can be overwhelmed about how do I go about doing it? And I think our key intervention is we have a point of view and a set of principles about how team leaders who are feeling kind of, you know, a lot of them are feeling overwhelmed. Some of the stats from ONS and Gallup say almost half of the team leaders in the UK and in the North are feeling just overwhelmed by their responsibilities. So giving them a roadmap for a path to improvement, I think, is just critical to unlock engagement, fun and enjoyment with the teams they lead.
Now, that is a very interesting point. Engagement rather than just enjoyment. Yeah, going to work should be obviously a joyful thing. It shouldn't be purgatory for people. But the purpose of work isn't just for enjoyment.
Absolutely. I think it's that we're seeing, and I'd be interested in your view, we're seeing that engagement is under strain. But, you know, the funds, there's not enough fun out there. There's not enough engagement. There's not enough connection with purpose. And this sort of expectations and ability is coming further apart, which is a real challenge. And actually, we're losing some of the glue, right? And we think the team leaders and the team are the glue. And what we see is post-COVID, I think teams have a lot more connection. There's almost technology, there's Zoom, Teams, chat, Slack, etc. But actually, meaningful connections, meaningful collaboration with the people you work with most closely, I feel that's under threat.
I was just going to say, are you talking about where you've mentioned Zoom and so on? Do you think it's the lack of or the reduction of face-to-face interactions or more staged face-to-face interactions? I know people who work remotely who maybe go and have a whole team meeting once a month. Do you think it's, yeah?
I think the key, our point of view is the key thing, it's how you interact, not where, right? You can have super engaged, productive teams that never meet. And similarly, you can have super unproductive, disengaged teams that sit in the same office, right, or sit in the same factory. So the key thing for us is how and how teams kind of build that sense of purpose and connection and cohesion and drive performance, right? And we view there's there's two games that teams have to play. We kind of talk about this inner game. How does this group work together? How do they trust each other? How do they kind of be resilient and tough? And that's a team sport, not an individual sport. So that inner game is key, but that's not enough. Actually, it's how they then influence the people they need to influence. It's about how they kind of are thinking about how can we make what we do better tomorrow, not just today. So this blend of inner and outer, we think is critical kind of to build the glue, to build the connection, and to build meaningful collaboration. And for us, that's absolutely the path to productivity.
I think it was Paul Krugman, the economist, that said productivity isn't everything, but it's almost everything. I thought we might have got the quote derivation wrong, but...
Yeah.
And it is, isn't it?
I think it's just like, it's such an important marker of, you know, how well are we doing? And is how we're working now a good predictor of what we can do tomorrow? And for me, it's that looking down the road, productivity is such an important forecaster and predictor of what's going to happen, which for me is why it's one of the most important things. Because if it's not where we wish it to be, we know we're storing up problems that are going to be even tougher to deal with tomorrow.
If I can ask a question, please. Now, the UK's productivity has been pretty flat for a number of years, but we're not the only country that's experienced the pandemic and the shift to working from home, the things that we spoke about. Why is Britain so far behind many other countries in terms of productivity?
Yeah, so I have a perspective. I think there's too much of the how we've tried to get better is based on guesswork versus real data driven insight. So sometimes we may guess right, but a lot of times we won't. So I don't think there's enough grounding in having some real data-driven diagnostics to help us pinpoint where we need to, you know, what adjustments do we need to make to drive productivity? And then because of that, I think a lot of what's offered is very generic. So it's kind of generic interventions, generic solutions that may work, but typically don't. And just, I think the customized nature of how teams drive productivity, it has to be contextual to where the team is, what the team are doing, and how, you know, what they need in that moment. So for me, they're two really important factors. And out in the L&D space, I think too many of the offerings are based on kind of generic guesswork, sadly.
Okay, a fair point well made there. But can I ask a slightly tangential question? There's a report in many of the press this week about UK productivity in terms of public sector being worse than people realised. And the fact being that the government itself is asking a lot of the private sector businesses that watch this podcast, and they are rising to the, as you heard, Josh and I saying, you know, rising to the challenge. But really, there is a disconnect between many in the private sector who are going to have to improve their productivity to deliver the profits that are going to deliver the money for the public sector. But the public sector productivity isn't improving. I lose count of the number of people who run businesses and just say, well, what are the taxes for if we can't get productivity in the public sector?
Yeah. I think it's a great call. We do quite a lot of work in the public sector. When we start the work, we have a diagnostic. We find a lot of focus about delivering today, right? Around sort of execution, hitting targets, hitting key performance indicators. It's grounded in today. My view is relative to the private sector, the muscle of how are we delivering value for tomorrow is less well formed, right? And I think we just get stuck, right? So you get stuck in a cycle of being super busy, delivering for today, feeling resource constrained, and therefore not being able to take the time to say, hang on, let's put our foot on the ball for a minute and just think, where can we get those productivity gains? And just that time to do that reflection, to drive that action that's oriented to the future, it's something we don't see enough of when I compare our work in the public and the private sector.
One follow-up question on this. without giving the impression that I think all of the public sector is not productive, I've encountered two public services recently where productivity, in my view, was very good. One was a friend of mine had her passport replaced because it had run out, and she applied for the passport, and within a few days, the passport was sorted out and had arrived. Whereas a few years ago, there were huge delays on passports. I recently traded a car in, and within hours, I had a notification from DVLA telling me the trade-in had happened, and within days, I would have a refund on my roadfund license. Now, it strikes me that both of those productivity improvements and those good services arose because of technology. And it's where technology can't be brought into the public sector or even some private sector organisations that productivity isn't necessarily improving, because you're needing to get more out of the human relations, your HR, rather than your technical products.
Yeah, and I think it's the number one for me. It's like, let's how good are we at cloning excellence, right? So you sound like that, and there's excellence in pockets in all parts of the organizations we work with. It comes back to that. How do we really deeply understand that customer journey, the DVLA, the buying the car, right? And how do we have the energy, capacity, motivation, space to really optimize it? And I think when that's in place, you know, fantastic things can happen. But it's just this sense of stuckness. I think there's too many teams, too many parts of organizations are just in this sort of in this looping, that they're not then able to make those breakthroughs and make those leaps that delivers the type of experience that you talked about.
Now, I want to ask you a question as well, which is about the public sector. I don't want to get too political about things. And obviously, we had Jacob Rees-Mogg over here trying to run the Brexit efficiencies department or whatever it was called, and as far as I could tell, didn't achieve much. Now we've got Musk over in America with DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, I think it is. What kind of things are you maybe hoping to see Elon coming out with?
Put
you on the spot, Dan.
Hard to go there without getting political, but you know, great question. I'd say it would be the judicious, thoughtful use of really advanced technology that doesn't just drive efficiency, but just drives, you know, excellence in experience for the citizens of the US, right, who are consuming it, right? For me, that's the, and not everything can get kind of engineered out through technology or AI, but I would say if that could go up from the current level to the next level across the services, then that could be that's got to be a force for good.
On that, the technology element, and what I said at the very beginning of this program, I went to a company in North Yorkshire that makes robots for pharma and food, and its order book for the robots is full for the whole of next year. And it strikes me that for everything that we've said in this conversation, there is an inevitable outcome of fewer jobs and redundancies. Do you feel that is a necessary shakeout? Is it also inevitable? Am I wrong to suggest it is?
So my view is it's different work, would be my view. So, you know, I'm a half a mathematician and half a behavioral scientist. That's kind of like, well, if you split me in half, that's what I have. So I think the advancements in science, the advancements in artificial intelligence, ethical intelligence, etc. But we're dialing up that need for that humanistic connection, empathy, thoughtfulness, values and ethics that sits within what we design. So I think we are in the middle of a real transition that's going to influence, you know, the ways of working for you know, the next generation, my children and their children's children, for sure. I don't know how it's going to shape out, but I do feel it's about adjustment and adaption versus a stop and start would be my perspective on the question.
Well, it sounds like it's either going to be utopia or dystopia, really, doesn't it, from what you've just said there?
Well, I think people like Rob guiding us, we might get some sort of stable middle ground.
trying to get a bit of both, right? It's like, it's not one or the other. And I think there's tension and strain and paradox. And I think if you can avoid the extremes, generally you can find a really constructive way forward.
Rob, thank you very much for joining us. And Alice, thank you for telling us the story. Do you think either of us should audition for the Dream Boy?
You're welcome to come on. All three of you.
All right, there we are. So lecture my performance today on the podcast has been worthy enough to turn to the next brand.
Thank you very much. Now, we're preparing our podcasts for next year. If you'd like to join us as a guest on the Northern Business Podcast, get in touch. Use LinkedIn to get in touch with Recognition PR. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks to our podcast producer today, Harry Sinclair, our technical operator, Robin Campbell. Join us next time for the Northern Business Podcast. Never miss an episode. Like, rate and subscribe on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts.